Our dear Father in Heaven, we're thankful that we have this opportunity to meet together, to listen and hear words about some of thy children. We ask thee that thy spirit might be with those who are speaking to us, and with us as well as we listen, that we might be able to understand and gain a better appreciation of the fullness of thy gospel and thy love for all the people in the world. We're thankful for this opportunity and opportunities like this that we have to meet together and to grow together more in a brotherhood and sisterhood of all mankind and womankind. We're thankful for being able to come here to this world, enjoy life, and to learn and suffer together. And we ask for thy guidance, and we're thankful for the teachings that we can learn. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Lee. Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning for the traditional devotional service for this year's Sunday West. Janet Kincaid and I are mindful that our departure from the usual format for the symposium devotional program, hold a memorial service in memory of a young man from our local community who took his life rather than endure the pain of being gay in a Mormon world, has met with opposition. It is not our agenda, or it is not our intent to promote a so-called gay agenda this morning, or to disparage the attitudes or feelings of the families of these men. We simply wish to commemorate and remember the lives of the 20 or so men who in the past 25 years are known to have made the tragic decision to end the struggle with a hostile world. We hope you will take a moment of your time to visit the Affirmation website where the names and a brief biography of these men have been posted. A printed copy of that page is going to be circulated. There are 13 whose names are known. Scott Allred, Kip Eliason, Farrell Rollins Hurst, John Michael Inman, Carlisle D. Marsden, Jacob Lawrence Orozco, Paul Boyd, Jared Pomeroy, D.J. Thompson, Stephen Larry Wheeler, Clay Douglas Whitmer, a David from the United Kingdom, and Henry Stuart Mattis. On the morning of February 25th, last year, after writing a note to his family, Stuart Mattis drove to the Los Altos State Center, where Elder Jeff Holland was holding a meeting for the full-time missionaries, and shot himself in the head outside on the steps. The enormous outpouring of grief and concern led his family to hold a memorial service on the 1st of March. Robert Reese spoke at that service, and we have asked him to share with you some of his comments. Stuart's decision to take his life came at a wretched time, when his own church was embroiled in a campaign to forestall the possibility of same-sex marriages in California. Many were deeply affected by what Stuart did. Thea Hillman wrote a poem that expresses how his death changed her life. She will follow Robert. And by the way, she has a book published, and there's some information here about this book if you're interested. There comes a time in some of our lives when a conflict we have is no longer ours. Before that point come many years of fighting a battle with an unknown enemy. It usually takes time to recognize that enemy. It can come from within. It can come from someone close, a family member or a friend. It can come from further away, an institution, a rival, or your church. The battle leaves bloodless scars. It shatters your trust in everything. You spend time on your knees, searching for strength to resist. The answers are not there. You spend more and more time begging, eating, crying, fasting, praying, and praying, and praying. You seek out a sacred grove and spend a day like Enos. Day in and day out, the battle goes on. Sleep comes only after exhaustion from fighting the beast. There is no one who can help. Priesthood blessings may seem shallow, given by men who have no clue of the battle below their outstretched arms. Torment turns to self-doubt. You reread the scripture that promises to help to those who ask, to make sure that there isn't some condition not met. The enemy toys with your hopes, your sense of justice, will to live. Years go by and still no answer. An occasional lull in the conflict gives you hope, false hope. The enemy's still there, and now there are scars on top of scars. You search the faces of every passing stranger, hoping to find someone who will understand, someone who can give solace, someone who can bring peace. The one who looks promising hurries by, unaware of your desperation. The scriptural promise rings hollow: ask and ye shall receive. Nothing. Prayers become raw. The words are no longer thee and thou. There is little gratitude in them. You cry the words, and then you wail the words, and then you scream the words. You curse yourself for your own weaknesses. Oh, why can't I find the strength to change? Is there anything that I deserve? Am I so depraved that I can't get some help? Despair is everywhere. The happiness of others mocks you. You bargain with him. Oh, how maddening. The silent screams turn inside out. They rage. They shatter the quiet of your sacred grove. The echoes never come back. You are alone. There is nothing left to give. Nothing. No emotion, no fight, no hope. That's when the battle is no longer yours alone, when there's nothing left to give. You grasp the one who can help, others who may have fought and won, someone who says he understands. For some, the battle is won. For me, she came from afar. For others, it is not. The help is fleeting. They don't really understand. They just don't get it. Now the screams are unconditional, terminal. No more bargaining with God. Screaming, screaming, screaming. How does one scream to God that it is enough? Robert?
About a year and a half ago, I received a telephone call from an institute director over in the side of the valley asking if I would be willing to speak with a young friend of his. I said that I would. And when that person hadn't called me, I called him. His name was Stuart Mattis. And when the phone was answered, it was answered by his mother. And I introduced myself. She knew who I was. And I said I wanted to talk to Stuart, and she said, well, I think he's too depressed to talk to you. And I said, well, that's why I want to talk to him. And I wasn't able to speak to Stuart on that occasion, but she said she would have him call me. And I guess it was a week or two later, Stuart called, and I invited him to my home. He came over on a Sunday evening, and we spent a couple of hours together. I have considered the times that I've been privileged to speak with and counsel with gay Latter-day Saints among the more sacred experiences of my life, and this certainly was no exception. I found Stuart to be an absolutely remarkable young man, one of the most impressive young men that I think I'd ever met. And as we talked for some time, I could see what a terrible dilemma he was in, caught between his sense of devotion to covenants and to the authority to which he had given his allegiance, and to an inner turmoil about his identity as a gay Latter-day Saint. As we talked, he told me a number of things about his experience, including his relationship with Clay Christensen, one of the other young men whose name was read. Clay and Stuart were missionary companions. Neither one, during the period of their mission, revealed to the other that he was gay, but they continued a friendship after their mission, a friendship which was a deep friendship, but nothing more. And Stuart was very concerned about Clay as we talked, and worried about Clay's being self-destructive, but he was also worried about his own self-destructive tendencies. As we talked, I felt the goodness of his soul. I tried to convince him that, above all of the things, God loved him. He had difficulty believing that because of his experience of trying to get God to change him and somehow help him find some way out of the dark labyrinth in which he found himself entrapped. I spoke with him on a number of occasions after that. I was worried about him, and I told him I was worried about him. And I tried strongly to encourage him to choose life, whatever it meant, over death. I spoken to him just a couple of days before I went to Salt Lake City to present an address called In a Dark Time, The Eye Begins to See, Personal Reflections on Homosexuality in the Mormon Church at the Beginning of a New Millennium. And in that talk, I referred to my experience with Stuart. And this piece is called Requiem for a Gay Mormon in Memory of Henry Stuart Mattis. I returned after midnight on Monday, February 28th, to find a message on my answer machine that my friend Stuart Mattis had taken his life. It took me a long time to get to sleep, and then I slept fitfully. The next morning, heavy of heart, I drove to a meeting in Monterey, about 40 miles down the coast from Santa Cruz, where I live. To try and find some solace from the dolorous news of the night before, I listened to Beethoven's Missa Solemnis and Brahms' German Requiem. Beethoven's Mass for the Dead begins with a quartet of solo voices singing Kyrie Eleison, God have mercy. Out of that quartet, a single tenor voice repeats the Kyrie with such piercing clarity and beauty that it sounds as if the voice of an angel was singing over the broken world itself. That voice became my prayer, not only for Stuart Mattis, but also for all of us who make up a world in which such senseless deaths as his occur. I had been in Salt Lake City the Sunday before addressing a gathering of gay and lesbian Latter-day Saints and their families and friends. In my remarks, I referred to Stuart, although by the pseudonym of David. I had been counseling with Stuart over the past several months and was both impressed with him and worried about him. In my remarks, I said, Stuart is one of the finest Latter-day Saints I've ever met, a person of great integrity who has struggled with the issues of faith and same-sex attraction for the entirety of his adult life. I spoke about our association and my attempts to convince him of God's love for him. I said, I worry about this man and I pray for him, and for the countless others like him who suffer unspeakably because, for reasons none of us understands, they love their own gender. Part of what it means to be a Christian is that through the grace of Christ we have the capacity to imagine what it is like to suffer as another suffers. It is impossible to do this if we have anger or hate or revulsion for the other. Such imaginative projection is possible only within the context of love. Thus, those who revile and persecute homosexuals, who treat them as if they had some kind of sinister agenda, cannot possibly take on their suffering, cannot possibly hope to feel what they feel. But those of us whose compassion is inspired by Christ can feel, at least to some degree, what it must be like to be anathema to society. We can imagine what it must feel like to hate our own bodies, to be condemned for feeling what we naturally feel, to be denied normal fellowship within Christ's kingdom, and to want to blot out our deep soul suffering through suicide. Stuart's last communications are filled not with imagined feelings of depression, self-loathing, and despair, but with their overwhelming reality. In a letter to the BYU student newspaper, he wrote, "For 2 decades, I've traveled down a torturous path of internalized homophobia, immense self-hatred, depression, and suicidal thoughts." In a letter written to his family the night before he took his life, he wrote, "As you know, I've been suicidal for years, and in the past year, I've been vocal about my feelings. After a year of expressing my grief to you, I realized that there's nothing that any of you could do to attenuate my pain. I simply could not live for another day choking on my own feelings of inferiority." It is startling to realize that a person of such brightness, goodness, and integrity could, through the ignorance and sensitivity and hatred of others, be reduced to such a state. And yet, who among us has the strength to hold on to our sense of self in the face of a continual maelstrom of negative feedback? We all need validation. We need the mirrors of other people's faces and voices, those of loved ones as well as those of strangers, to position ourselves in the palpable world. The saddest thing I heard about Stuart was the revelation by his mother at a memorial service held the Wednesday following his death. She quoted Stuart as saying, "I have never told you that I have loved you because I was holding my feelings of love so tightly inside that I couldn't risk expressing them to anyone." Even repeating these words here fills me with profound sadness. I feel Stuart had both a great need for love and a great capacity for love. This was evidenced by the concern he had for young Latter-day Saint homosexuals. He spoke of them often. He spoke often of the teenage boys and girls who were beginning to face their homosexuality. He anguished over their loneliness. He despaired over the realization that many of them would go through the same cycle he had gone through. He wanted to save them from experiencing the darkness of soul that he had suffered. Stuart intended that the ultimate act of his life would somehow help these young people. In his letter to his family quoted above, he said, "Perhaps my death might become the catalyst for much good. I'm sure that you will now be strengthened by your resolve to teach the members and the leaders regarding the true nature of homosexuality. My life was actually killed many years ago. Your actions might help save many young people's lives." Driving back to Monterey the morning after I had heard of Stuart's death, I was comforted by the words of a chorus in Brahms' Requiem, "How lovely is thy dwelling place, O Lord of hosts. My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth, for the courts of the Lord." The concluding chorus of the Requiem expressed the feelings of my heart. "Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they rest from their labors, and their works do follow them." I miss Stuart, and I mourn for the joy he might have experienced in this life, and the love he might have experienced from and given to others. In his famous meditation on death, John Donne wrote, "Who can remove from that bell for the dying, which is passing, a piece of himself out of the world? No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." The bell that tolls for Stuart Mattis tolls for us all, for somehow we're all diminished by the passing of so good a human being. In Stuart's honor, I would like to say that I think that the sense that some people have, and the sentiment that sometimes someone feels heard expressed in the church, that it is a parent would rather see a child dead than unchaste, is, I think, a doctrine which, like the teaching the fathers have eaten grapes and the children's teeth have been set on edge, that Jeremiah said should be taught no more in Israel. I remember a conversation I had once with Elder Marion B. Hanks, in which we were talking about this, and with an angry passion he said, "I can't imagine any circumstance under which I'd rather have one of my children dead than alive. And I can't imagine under any circumstance in which I would rather have one of my gay brothers and sisters dead than alive. I hope they all choose life, and I hope we all can help them do so."
Going door to door on Dolores today. Today, Dolores, on my street, door knocking. And I've never seen them on my street before. 22 Mission, 16th and Mission, maybe, Tenderloin, downtown. But do we need to be saved on Dolores? And the interesting thing is, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for them. Door knocking is one of the hardest things in the whole world. I did it for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, up 14 flights of stairs in 8 buildings in the Crown Heights housing projects through New York summer and New York winter. I know how tough it is, door knocking. And believing is hard. I mean, not believing is hard, but believing is even harder. When you think you have the answer, something good, important, and it's your job to tell everyone else, and it's your job to get them to change. No, it's your job to save them. A lot of work. Believing. Being right. Being Mormon. Some of my best friends are Mormon. Really. Always have been. Since growing up in a community with a large contingent. Kind and community oriented and giving. But my Mormon friend Janie, who's been in a 3-year crisis and depression because she fell in love and had a relationship with a woman. Janie, who could be excommunicated from her church and is the only community she's ever known. Janie sent me the email about the tormented 33-year-old Mormon guy who shot and killed himself in front of his church. Because of a lot of things, but because he literally could not exist in the world as he knew it. His parents knew he was gay, and they still loved him. And he still killed himself. Because he believed what he'd been taught. That he couldn't be Mormon and gay. I don't believe anymore. I don't door knock anymore. And maybe violence isn't just explosive moments that we can't take back. Maybe violence roils in our hearts and minds unformed, turns like potentials in our hands and mouths. And maybe violence isn't black and shiny and hard or sharp. Maybe violence is the fleshy repetition of thoughtlessness, the reiteration of ritual, the written word, and the wisdom of the ages unquestioned, knocking, unheeded, desire unanswered. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert and Thea. It's customary in a memorial service to invite any from the audience who is moved to make a comment or to express some feelings. And so we have a few minutes left in our program. If there's anyone who would like to come up and add to our service, they're welcome. This is Mary Blanchard.
I would just like to say that when someone looks into your eyes and you look back and you see a template instead of a person, and this person is looking some way to be reflected in your eyes and to be made more whole, and you send him back a message of annihilation, that you are helping to destroy this person. And I know this happens from infancy on in all of our lives in little bits, and I cannot conceive of the difficulty that people go through who are in a minority and who look into our eyes and cannot find their place. And I know that people can be driven to a place in a corner where there's no way out, suicide. My sister killed herself last September. And her family was fortunate enough to have Von Featherstone in their ward, who gave an apostolic blessing, saying she's in the arms of a loving father who is soothing her horror and pain. I wish that our gay brothers and sisters could look to our eyes and feel that soothing, because we see them there for who they are and not for who someone tradition says they should be.
Thank you, Marie. Is there anyone else? Mary Jane? Mary Ellen?
You got the first one right. There's a theorist who wrote regarding Mormonism in the field of religious studies, saying that she was critiquing the way Mormons sometimes treat women poorly. And the way she put it was that until the tradition fully accepts women, it has no hope of achieving wholeness. And I would say that until our religious tradition fully accepts, loves, tolerates, and celebrates the gay Mormons among us, we have no hope of achieving wholeness. And I hope that we will be able to do that without losing any more people from our ranks.
Thank you.
I've had some very special experiences in my life with young men who are gay. And the first one was when my husband and I, years ago, you can tell our dates, worked with the M-Men and Gleaners. And one of our... you know what I mean. You younger people don't know, but anyway. We were the, quote, advisors, although they really ran the program, and one of our officers was a young man who was a returning missionary, who was gay, and, well, there's a big story around that, but when the word got out. But he was an officer, and a wonderful man, and a wonderful singer. And I'd like to add his name to the list. Is there anything that is necessary to do that? His name is Douglas Ramsey. And his sister was a wonderful singer, and he was a wonderful singer. And I used to play for them sometimes. And the most beautiful rendition I ever heard was their singing the duet from Porgy and Bess. And it was absolutely gorgeous. And I will never forget it. That sound is in my head from all those years. After he left the area in Los Angeles, I didn't hear anything more of him until we heard the bad news that somewhere in San Francisco he had taken off all of his identifying clothes and gone in a hotel room and whatever he did, passed away. And it took some time for them to identify who that was. But I know that he was facing the same problems those many years ago before this became more openly discussed. And of course, him all this morning, as we talked about this, the other young men. Then, as a musician, which is not true just of musicians, but I happen to have worked with a first singer in Los Angeles, a wonderful, wonderful singer. Dale Morick was his name, not LDS, but he was just a great artist. And some years after I worked with him, he passed away from throat cancer, which I suspect was caused by some other disease. And then I was a partner with a saxophonist, and we were a duo. And I saw him through his bout with AIDS, and I visited with him every few days and held his hand, and he just said, "Be here." And his parents came from the Midwest about 6 months before he passed away, and they never could accept his lifestyle. They thought that coming to California is what did it. But he, they were very, you know, I know. But he was a wonderful musician, and we performed many places around the world together, and I wrote a lot of music for him, which has since been recorded by other artists. But the day before he died, I was there, and as I, he could not really talk much. I brought him some roses because he could smell. And I held the roses under his nose, and he didn't say anything that whole day. And so as I was there for about an hour, and as I walked out, he said, "Give me a kiss." And so I went over and I gave him a kiss, and I went to the door and I said, "Goodbye, Paul." And, but I have a very special place in my heart for these wonderful people. It has nothing to do with their being gay or whatever. I mean, that was never even part of our conversation. But they're wonderful people, and I appreciate them very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Gosh, it's starting to feel a little bit like testimony meeting in here. I never like to be part of that either. But I do have something to say. My name is Yvette Hansen, and my husband is actually speaking at the 10 o'clock session regarding the aftermath of Prop 22 in our household. And I won't go further into that because you can go hear him speak if you want to hear about that. But I bring it up because it's what brings me forward. In looking back on that time, just a few days before we had heard that Stuart had taken his life, a newspaper article came out in Salt Lake City, very far from where we lived in California, on the front page of the Salt Lake Tribune about my husband and I and our activity opposing Proposition 22 and the church's campaign for it. in our small town. That was Sunday. It was quiet that morning at our house, but in the afternoon, I suppose when the word started letting out in Salt Lake City, we started getting telephone call after email after telephone call in an endless string from young men in Utah who had read the article. Tearful young men, teenagers who were afraid to tell their parents that they were gay. My husband wasn't home that day. He was meeting with our bishop, who had also got wind of the story. So I got to be, I told my husband that night, half kidding and half horrified, it feels like I've been running the suicide crisis line here at home. Mostly young men called, a few young women, mostly young men, all from Mormon families, almost all under the age of 18. Two or three telling me that their mothers were asking them why they weren't preparing more enthusiastically for missions soon to come. And these young men would tell me how they felt they couldn't go on a worthy mission. They didn't feel good enough. They didn't feel worthy enough. And yet these young people were actually fighting harder than any of their friends to stay worthy. I spoke to some incredible young people that day. One or two of whom I wish I would hear from again, because I'm very concerned about them. A few we actually have kept in contact with. But when we did hear of Stuart's death just a few days later, I think it actually brought it home for me that these young men that were calling me and reaching out to us felt so alone, so completely alone in their world, that calling long distance from a pay telephone in Salt Lake City was the only way they could really feel human contact from somebody that they knew would love them unconditionally. And I thought about my own very small little boys and that they're going to grow up to be 16, 17, 18. And I don't ever want them to feel that they can't come home to me with whomever that they love and know that Mom still loves them, because she's Mom, doesn't have anything to do with sexuality. I hope that when we all look at our children, that's what we can remember. That we're Mom and Dad. We're not God. And the Mormon Church isn't God either. And that's, I think, what my husband and I have had to come to grips with this year. I won't say any more on the subject because I'll ruin my husband's talk. But I just wanted to tell you that if there are those people, I know it's easy sometimes to sit and say, well, it was just this isolated case. It isn't an isolated case. There are too many of our young people feeling the way Stuart felt every day of their lives. And I don't want to lose another one of them. I hope you don't either. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. I like that metaphor. A long-distance telephone call from a from Salt Lake City to California. Thank you.